Welcome to another episode of Think You Know the Presidents with me, Flora McCarthy.
And me, Lise Hand.
Right, today it's all about Sean T. O'Kelly, Ireland's second president.
He served actually two terms, 1945 to 1959, and they were fairly grim times in Ireland. Yeah. But he actually was more crack than most people think he was.
He was also a man who managed to enrage the Pope, Lise, and Joseph Stalin. And he also married two sisters.
Not
at the same time.
That's all right. Let's just clear that up from the start, in fairness.
But we've got help today, which is great, because we're joined by historian Liz Gillis, who's got plenty of nuggets of her own. Great to have you, Liz.
Thanks so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
So, Flora, do you remember the last episode we were talking about a certain president who went on the razzle-dazzle with President Eisenhower?
Oh, could I forget?
Well, that's what we're talking about now.
The man who knew how to live it up with his barrels of Guinness and the Oris during his two terms.
God, Flora, I mean, are you trying to put the goo in me? We're only starting the show.
Goo and the Pope.
Goo and the Pope in the same paragraph.
It's 11 o'clock, girl.
Four 408 years after Henry VIII was crowned King of Ireland, era cuts its last link with Britain. President Sean O'Kelly, the new state's first leader, joins a dense crowd in Dublin's O'Connell Street as the flag of ERA is hoisted on the GPO building. Here, as the veterans of the 1916 rebellion still recall, was the headquarters of the Sinn Féin Rising. And here, 33 years later to the day, the new ERA officially becomes an independent republic.
So we're kicking off in 1945 and into the 1950s. And let me tell you, I wasn't there myself, but it was zero crack, priest-ridden and bloody freezing.
Yeah, it certainly was. And I mean, you could not literally open a cupboard without a priest falling out of it.
I've got involved in a lot of these stories.
Yeah.
Gradually, Ireland moves away from that.
It does, yeah. But I mean, definitely this was the decade where there was no getting away from the church at all.
Priests and prelates and padres and a pope or two. Liz, tell us a bit about Sean T. O'Kelly.
Thank God social media didn't like exist at his time, because I think it would have broke it, because he just seemed to be that type of person, again, who knew how to spread the word, get things done. Like, well, he worked in newspapers with Arthur Griffith. He started his career out as a junior assistant in the National Library, but then resigns because, like, it was a British institution. That's not for him, because he was a total Republican. But then goes to work in newspapers. But also that, coupled with the fact that he was in local government, so he knows how to deal with politicians and get things done, but is also dealing with the everyday life of ordinary people, which then translates when he is the Minister for Local Government in the Fianna Fáil era. Like, he oversees the building of the public housing, which is a huge success. And De Valera said about him,
popular now.
Oh, so much so. Like, they built 12,000 houses a year over the 10-year period when money was pretty tight, but because he'd come from that background in local government, he knew how to get things done. And as Dev said about him, the greatest legacy or monument to Sean T is the housing that he built.
Yeah. He was very different, wasn't he, from our first president, Hyde, who was a Protestant from a rural background and the grand house. Here's O'Kelly, inner city Dublin boy, and as Catholic as they come.
Big family, working class family. He was a twin, although his twin sister died when she was young. She was about four when she died. He goes to the O'Connell schools, which, if you look later on, Frangach in Termacamp has been called the University of Revolution. Well, O'Connell schools was the preschool of the revolution, because anyone who was anyone in revolution seemed to went to O'Connell schools. You have this generation of people who are being educated by the Christian Brothers. And as I said, the O'Connell schools is instrumental in creating that revolutionary generation. He's very much involved in the Gaelic League, and then gets involved, joins the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which is that secret revolutionary organisation, being part of the most radical groups, the central branch of the Gaelic League, Teal and Circle of the IRB. And from very early on, he is meeting people who would be the key players. Like, two of his siblings were educated at St. Enda's, the school set up by Patrick Pearce. He gets in with everyone very early on, very personable with them, both from Tom Clark, who is the puppet master behind the 1916 Rising, to the lowest rank and file volunteers. He is there. Joints of volunteers when they're set up. He's a member, found a member of Sinn Féin. So everything that happens in the early years of
he's there.
Everywhere. And shown his sort of his quality as a speaker, as a diplomat, For want of a better word.
He went off to Paris, didn't he?
Goes off to Paris in 1919. But before that, he's sent to New York in 1915 to meet with the Clan na Gael, who are funding, going to fund any rebellion. He's the one that's sent. He's the one that's networking. And he does that very successfully. If you think about it, he's actually more global. He's global before De Valera is global. Put it that way. He's the one that is sent and he's networking. He's that link between Ireland and America, which then that link leads to the revolution, the 1916 rising. Takes part in it. Although he's a captain in the volunteers, he's not really a military man. He serves in the GPO in 16, but he's actually sent to put up, to post up the proclamation. As he himself said, he was the official bill poster for the Republic. Imagine running around O'Connell Street like going, yeah, put up. But then he's arrested after 1916. He's put in prison, not court-martialed. And what saves him from that is that he had actually wanted to get his volunteer uniform made. It was too close to the horizon, so he couldn't get his volunteer uniform made. So when he was arrested, he's not wearing a uniform. He's seen as not important. Big mistake by the Brits at the time.
And of course, he knew these streets really well, didn't he? This is where he'd grown up.
Oh, that was a stomping ground. Like, that's his home turf. And coupled with that, on the other side, you have the women being educated as well. Mm. The Gaelic League is the key because the Irish language, the revival of the Irish language, it brings all these people together. They're learning their own culture, but that's politicising them at this time. But then he goes to meet his future wife. So he married Kit Ryan from one of the sisters of the famous Ryan family from Tom Cool. And like these,
why were they famous?
So these, they were a totally Republican family. So you have Kit, you have Agnes, you have Min Ryan, you have Phyllis, there was Nell and then their brother Jim. And they were all involved in the revolution, either through marriage or, well, with their own activities. These were like the socialites of the Republican movement. Kit, who married Sean T in 1918, Easter Monday 1918, they were like their house in Ranelagh Road, her house in Ranelagh Road was the place to go for parties. And Sean T would go, like he, in like they introduced Sean McDermott, like everyone goes to their house for a party. But they were amazing in their own right because they were international, like they were educated. They went to all of these countries, Spain, London, Germany to teach. But Kit, who Sean T marries, she was a translator. She was actually ended up being a professor of French in UCD. Now, that obviously helps him later when he's over in Paris going, no, teach me some words, please. So she was able to, you know, do that for him. But she wasn't with him because she was doing her job. But Min Ryan, she was Sean McDermott's sweetheart. Like she's the last person with her sister Phyllis, I think it was, to see Sean McDermott in the cell before he's executed in Comanum Jail in 1916. Jim served in the GPO along with Sean T. O'Kelly, as did Min and her sister Phyllis. Phyllis herself, who has that connection with Sean T, she was a chemist. She graduated as
really
a chemist.
Women, weren't they?
Oh, totally well ahead of their game.
Isn't it amazing?
Really well.
I just heard nothing about them. I mean, you hear about, you know, the Guinness sisters and you hear about the Mitford sisters and so on. And this is obviously an extraordinary family.
No wonder he wanted to marry another sister when Kit died.
Well, that's what happened because Kit passed away in 1934. But like Phyllis, he knew her. She knew him all her adult life. And they had to get a dispensation from the Pope to marry because the whole thing of not being able to marry a sister of, you know, your wife. But he got that. So there's the religious aspect coming into it. And they were married in 1936. Neither marriage. They had no children from either marriage. But then within 10 years of Phyllis marrying him, she then becomes the First Lady because he is elected president.
But you know, yeah, he was a serious looking fella as well. He always had that sort of high collar and a cravat going on and the little roundy glasses that to give, you know, give you that intellectual air and a bit of a serious face on him. But apparently he was good crack. I mean, apparently he enjoyed a party and grouped it up around town with various figures.
He did. And in fact, he opened up the Orrister parties. And there are some great descriptions of him trying to hide the bottles of whiskey or the kegs of Guinness that were known to be up in the Orrister.
Well, think about Sean T. He was a very small fella. He was so small, actually, that once he walked onto the Sacred Sword of Croke Park for a match and some wag in the crowd, "Ah, here, would you cut the grass? We can't see the president." So I always loved that story. And he tended to wear top hats and things, which obviously give himself a few extra inches on top, you know. And I think the Dublin cartoonists and all the Irish cartoonists had a great time with him. And of course, his wife didn't help the fact that his wife was a strapping woman. And towered over him. Yeah, she towered over
him. In more ways than one.
Yeah, I think she kept him, you know, kept a beady eye on him, you know, to make sure that he wasn't nipping off to the...
like the partying.
Yeah, nipping off the pub once too often.
You know, you remind me of just that actor, that what was his name? He's a friend of black and white movies and he always looked like he was...
One of the Grouchos? Like,
not Charlie Chaplin. The way to describe him is that he looked jolly. He did look like he has there's an air of mischievousness about him.
Not James Cagney, no.
No, he's that guy. He's the big guy. I can't remember his name.
John Wayne.
No. He's like the early talk.
He went up to the Everest wearing in a holster looking for a redhead to throw over his shoulder, yeah?
John Wayne. It's sort of what you'd expect to see actually on the stage of the Victorian era. Like, looked like someone that could have a good time. He was always on. He was dealing with people. He had to be that actor, you know, because he is playing a role. He's a diplomat. He's representing Ireland. So he had to have that persona and looked like you could have a bit of crack with him. And it's like a role he was always destined to play. Like, you look at his transition in politics, local government, Dublin Corporation. He is the envoy sent to Paris throughout the War of Independence. He is dealing with really high class politicians. Even before that, 1908, he goes and has an address in front of Pope Pius X. Like, he addresses him in Irish, and that was a big deal because that's where Éamon Cant, who was executed in 1916, he was an Uilleann piper, he plays in front of the Pope, nearly deafens him, but a whole legation were sent over. So Sean T is the man. They know who can handle any situations.
And sometimes representing Ireland, he kind of put his foot in it. There's a great little story. The first ever state visit by a president of Ireland had to be, of course, to where?
The Vaticano.
And the Vaticano, of course. So President Sean T. O'Kelly set off for Vatican City to meet with Pope Pius XII. All was going very well. Actually, he was escorted around Rome by Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, who's known as the Irish Schindler, who'd helped about 5,000 people escape the Nazis in secret tunnels under Rome that are still there. But the visit was a great success until the president was on his way home via Paris, a place, as you were saying, Liz, he knew well. He gave an interview to a group of journalists in which he revealed, shock, horror, the Pope's views on communism. So they weren't exactly complimentary, I'd guess. This had been a private conversation between O'Kelly and Pius XII, and it was a major embarrassment because he was now singing like a canary. Apparently Stalin was enraged, the Pope was hopping up and down livid, and it caused a serious diplomatic incident. So do you remember in the archives we found what's described as a most secret letter, which was dispatched from the Vatican over to Dublin advising foreign affairs or the Department of External Affairs, as it was then, that it is de rigueur never to refer to talks with HF, that's the Holy Father, I guess. Blessings and salutations are allowed, and that's it. And avoid all contacts with the press.
Well, which is something that probably does endure more or less onto this day.
So Liz, why was he chosen as president to run?
Well, he was always sort of in the running, but not for the first time when we had the president that becomes Douglas Hyde, because it wasn't contested, because Alfie Bourne, the Lord Mayor of Dublin, like the most popular Lord Mayor ever, a rumour went around he was going to run, and they all went, no one's going to win him. So Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Joe, well, right, let's put our heads together, we'll nominate someone we all agree with. So Douglas Hyde. So with Sean T, the next, when Douglas Hyde resigns, he's not going to stand for another term. So this is the first contested election. Mm. So you have Sean T being put forward. Now, the thing was, at that time, although he was really important in cabinet, Minister for Finance, Minister for Local Government, but he was a little bit loose-lipped. It seems it was suggested and believed that he was actually leaking information to the Knights of Columbanus about government, information.
Leaks, shock horror.
Yeah. And Dev told him, get out, leave. And he did, but then rejoined. So De Valera sort of, you know, wants to get him out because all this information coming out, going, who is it from? Most likely Sean T. So he is nominated, put forward by Fianna Fáil up against Sean McKeown, who was Fine Gael. And both of them are like big names in terms of the anti-treaty, pro-treaty, civil war divide. He wasn't nominated, or he wasn't elected on the first count. He is on the second count that he gets elected. And that sort of reflected the public opinion at the time, because Fianna Fáil, although emerged as this brilliant party for the working people, by 1945, they'd begun to lose popularity with the people. And they showed that with this result. So that's how he wins it. But it's not a clear run thing. It's not a given that he's going to get it. He has to work for it.
Of course, at this point in Ireland, the church and state were, they really were one and the same. I mean, there's more than one photo of a head of government or state kneeling to kiss the ring of a prince of the church.
And of course, O'Kelly was also a member of the Knights, that's Knight with a K, of St. Columbanus, a mysterious men-only Catholic society, like something I thought straight out of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
And I suppose if Ireland had an uncrowned monarch, it probably must have been John Charles McQuaid, officially Archbishop of Dublin, unofficially the High King of Ireland. And of course, especially, you know, he does play a role because obviously we had both a head of government and obviously Sean T. O'Kelly. They were very, very religious. And it's hard just to understate just what a shadow he cast over the sort of beginning, the particularly the 40s, 50s and 60s. I mean, he was only a little fella as well, kind of a ferrety face, but massively powerful. I mean, he was your classic sort of iron fist in a...
With the ribs.
In a silk glove.
Around the place.
Absolutely. I mean, apparently, if anybody in got a call from the palace, it was a source of dread because the Archbishop had picked up the phone in the Archbishop's official residence, Dublin's official residence, which was known as the palace. And it was normally to thunder down the phone about... Now, when I say anything, I literally mean anything. It could be to ban a book like The Country Girls and Edna O'Brien. It could be, and I hate to say this, but he actually involved himself in... he disapproved of the use of tampons by unmarried persons, which I think is kind of interesting. Does that make him woke because he used persons? Now, there's an interior mystery. But no one's ever thought of that one before. But, you know, he did have huge power.
He tried to ban women's sports.
He tried to ban women's sports.
Would entice the men when they were changing at the side.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
Instead of giving them changing facilities, just ban the women's sports instead.
And, you know, he was down on everything. I mean, on a serious note, he scuppered what was genuinely a piece of massively progressive proposed legislation, which was Noel Brown, and proposed the mother and baby scheme. Because as health minister, he was appalled at the awful state of prenatal care and care for young mothers. And again, JC got on the phone. Funny, his initials are JC, actually, isn't it, John Price? Got on the phone and started giving, you know, down with this sort of thing, classic. And they actually pulled the scheme because he thought that, he thought it was, you know, communistic and it was, you know, socialist and, you know, bad idea to give women ideas.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a serious thing. But he even actually was able to, you know, to order around the arras because famously Ireland were playing Yugoslavia in a football match and he massively disapproved of this because it was a communist country and they were all full of godless infidels, obviously. So in 1952, he actually managed to have it scuppered, but the FAI somehow found a set of, you know, a backbone. And they, when it was proposed again in 1955, they went ahead with it. But he wanted to, so John Charles wanted to boycott this and no do. But the government, the office of the Taoiseach ends up ringing Sean T and saying, you can't go. You're absolutely not allowed to go. And Sean T didn't go, which is pretty abject, really.
He had his grip on politics. Our first president, Douglas Hyde, when he died in 1949 and his funeral took place in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, neither the then president, O'Kelly, nor most of the cabinet were able to attend the service in the cathedral. Why? They had to stay outside because to attend a Protestant service was what was called a reserved sin, requiring the forgiveness of a bishop. So they sat outside in their cars. They waited the entire cabinet, except for one. Didn't Childers attend?
That's right. I think
he did.
Yeah.
And they waited until after the Requiem service and joined the cortege as the coffin was being carried out. What else is happening?
I mean, as well as the, you know, going around the business of trying to create a republic, the I suppose the government at the time and the president were going through the fraught business of trying to extract the new state from the clutches of the British Empire. This was sort of at that time. And I mean, it was a tricky mixture of brute force and diplomatic manoeuvring. I suppose it's a bit like wriggling out of a pair of Spanx after a night on the tiles.
I wouldn't know anything about
that. So, you know, when you look back, I suppose the royals were still looming very large around that, you know, around in the early days of the state. Yeah. And it was kind of a case of, you know, how do we solve a problem like Elizabeth? Because obviously she joined, you know, she got onto the throne in 1952. Then, of course, she was coronated, big fuss, back in 1953. And I just found this letter and they are literally bamboozled.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back after this.
The Irish government don't know what to do because an invite is on the way to the coronation. Of course, this puts him in a terrible old dilemma. So I found this absolutely great letter. And it was from our Irish ambassador, the very first one we had in London, and Henry Boland. And he had what he called a frank meeting. And it was about this very fraught issue. And in his diplomatic language, he told Sir Percival, has to be called Sir Percival, that he must regard anything in the nature of the special accreditation of an Irish representative to the coronation ceremony as being out of the question. The Irish government were anxious to avoid anything that might be construed as a personal affront to the British head of state at the moment of her coronation, but they were equally firmly averse to any action incompatible with their own feelings and the feelings of the Irish people as a whole about the continuation of partition and the extension of the new royal title to the six-county area.
So, God almighty.
So we take it that was a no. But then you see, and this is the other thing, that as they were trying to extract themselves from the royals, some people took a more robust view and they started blowing up every single thing in sight that had a queen or a king or any class of, you know, poobah from the British Empire on top of it.
Statues.
Toppling statues. And we've seen this, you know, in regimes, you know, when regimes topple all over the world. We've saw Saddam Hussein been dragged down, you know, in Baghdad. So this was sort of part of that sort of empire thing. I mean, obviously the most famous toppling statue was obviously poor old Nelson, who was blown to smithereens off his pillar in 1966, to massive amazement. In fact, and I just thought this was great, there was one report that then President Eamon de Valera rang the paper that his family owned and suggested a headline with massive unusual frivolity, and he thought that they should try the headline, British Admiral Leaves Ireland by Air. But I have to say, and just one more statue, I can't let this one pass. One of the statues they blew up was this lad on a big rampant horse, huge one of these big horses in Phoenix Park, Lord Hugh Gough. And one Dublin poet was moved to write a poem, marking this very poignant destruction. And the last verse goes, "There are strange things done from 12 to 1 in the hollow at Phoenix Park. There's maidens robbed and gentlemen robbed in the bushes after dark. But the strangest of all, within human recall, concerns the statue of Gough. 'Twas a terrible fact, a most wicked act, for his bollocks they tried to blow off." It's interesting, though, when you look at that, because obviously it's part of the whole move onto the world stage. Ireland were trying to sidle on to, you know, the international stage and make themselves known and make their presence felt and be taken seriously as a republic and a country and so on. So I just want to ask you, Liz, I mean, looking back at the events around 1948, would it be outrageous to suggest that Ireland, in fact, was kind of an accidental republic, the way that it all happened?
That's pretty much the way it can be looked at. Because what was happening with India was leaving the empire, and you have like the whole, there is a build up to it. It doesn't just actually happen out of the blue, but it does. if you know what I mean.
Suddenly, in the end,
yeah,
in the Republic.
Yeah, because we had sort of begun that process thanks to the abdication of King Edward VIII, where Dev saw the opportunity that we can start to remove ourselves from the Commonwealth and the External Relations Act, where the king is the head of the state, well, he's head of the group of countries, not head of the state. So that's like it's starting. But when India gets an independence, obviously it ramps up things. So Johnny Costello, who was the Taoiseach at the time, is in Ottawa. And he's asked by journalists what is happening with Ireland. And he did make a statement that they were thinking about repealing the External Relations Act, but not thinking that anyone would see it in a newspaper over in Ireland. Sean McBride, who is in the inter-party government at the time, he sees this and goes, now's me chance. And he lets the Sunday Independent know. And they have this big banner headline, Ireland to go, like the External Relations Act to go. And then it's like, it goes back to Ottawa and Johnny Costello's like going, holy crap, what's happening? And so the journalists then press him on it and it's like, yeah, we're leaving. Pretty much. And then it's like,
so then it's all go, green light.
That's it. You can't sort of take it back. So then he comes back to Ireland and it's like, you sort of jumped ahead of yourself a little bit there. And then they retrospectively go, oh yeah, we support this. So then it's Ireland becomes a republic. Then that whole process from 48 to 49. But what is amazing, and I loved this when I saw it, when on Republic Day 1949, and it was made the photographs of O'Connell Street and it's a big celebration. But you see in the newspaper, the Irish people get congratulated by the King of England for leaving the Commonwealth.
Isn't that incredible?
And you're like, what was that about?
There was a brilliant telegram we found from King George VI to congratulate the people of Ireland. And it said even at the end, so, and he sent it to O'Kelly on the Declaration of Ireland's Independence, 18th of April, 1949. I pray that every blessing may be with you today and in the future, and thanking the people of Ireland for their generous help during World War II.
So, I mean, after that telegram, Sean T, he did end up corresponding with King George VI. There was just a bit of back and forth between them, which is quite nice given that, you know, we were trying to get away from royalty at that time.
It's incredible given his background in the Rising as well.
Yeah, exactly. And he kind of admired how the King handled things and how he led his country, obviously, through the, you know, World War II. And, of course, King George, as we know now, I mean, he was Lizzie's da, Queen Elizabeth's da, and he's now King Charles' granda. Yeah, exactly. And, of course, he was portrayed very nicely by the lovely Colin Firth in that brilliant film, The King's Speech.
Very lovely.
But, you know, I do love looking at that photograph from, it's such a famous photograph of O'Connell Bridge.
Yeah.
The day that Ireland finally got out of the Spanx, I suppose you could say. It was the celebrations, obviously, on the 18th of April, 1949. This is history with a difference, folks. And it was just such a great scene because you have literally the biggest crowd you could imagine packed onto O'Connell Bridge. They just overflowed all the barriers that were put up, and there was a general melee, and the, you know, the bands were trying to get into play their thing. The cannons were there. Luckily, they didn't end up toppled into the sea, into the Liffey. And, you know, there was a 21, you know, gun salute. There was searchlights kind of raking the crowd to show the size of the crowd and all that. And people throwing their hats in the air and sort of tricolours flying and all that. And it's just a sort of great sense of excitement about it, you know. And I mean, this, of course, there were parades all over the country. I mean,
and the international reaction was brilliant as well. I mean, King George sent his good wishes, as we saw, and there were rakes of telegrams in from Nehru in India, from Fraser in New Zealand, President Harry Truman, from all over the world. But I found a little reference in the newspapers saying, "Ignored by North," said the headline. Apart from the ban on demonstrations by Northern Ireland Minister of Home Affairs and the consequent police precautions, Northern Ireland officially ignored the birth of the Republic.
Yeah, well, I suppose the path of least resistance, maybe on the just for the times they were in it.
Yes, there were practical changes too, weren't there? Like, up until now, the King really had the role as on the international stage for Ireland.
Yeah.
And O'Kelly now took over that.
Yeah, because up to this point, again, with that External Relations Act, it was the King was the head of the state for liaison with other states. So, for example, Irish ambassadors, if they need to go to visit a country, the King had to sign off. And you've got one ambassador and he's waiting 3 weeks for the King to, you go, oh yeah, you can go. But now, as we have a president, that role falls off the Republic. It falls on to Sean T. O'Kelly. And he is, at the end of the day, he is the one then that goes to represent the Republic on the international stage. He addresses the both houses of Congress in America. Now, that was really something. And that was on St. Patrick's Day. And that was really something because America sort of didn't really approve of us being neutral in the Second World War. And this is not too long after the Second World War. So him going and addressing both houses, it is seen as an act of reconciliation between the two countries.
Yeah, and you can. It's very interesting because when you listen to audio clips from his speech to the joint houses of Congress, you can hear the emotion in his voice. Yes. He literally says, I can hardly bring myself to speak because it meant so much for him. And, you know, it was such a momentous occasion.
I'm so filled with emotion for this, the warmth of the welcome you offer me and Ireland in my name, that I can hardly get my nerves calmed down enough to address you.
Again, it's about moving, you know, Ireland, you know, into the world stage. And as you rightly say, Liz, it was warming up that sort of very chilly post-war because they took a very, you know, very dim view to our neutrality. They really did. And a huge amount of pressure was been put on Ireland all the way through the war, which we've talked about before, about, you know, from FDR and so on, to kind of be more, you know, be more active. And
they were wearing green carnations in their lapels and... There's a shot of Nixon nodding off, though, so the speech might have gone on.
Oh, God, it probably did. Actually, you know, it probably did. But, of course, they were also, you know, being canny enough, because if you think back, 1 in 10 Americans, something like 33 or 34 million, were claiming to be of Irish descent. I mean, that's a hell of a chunk of your electorate as well. And I think at that point, 13 presidents up to that point had claimed Irish roots. And interestingly enough, from... the next one on, from John F. Kennedy on, right up to the current incumbent, every single one of those has claimed Irish roots. So it was part of pandering, I suppose, to that audience.
But can you imagine for O'Kelly personally what that meant? Because if you go back to him in 1915, where he's going over to negotiate and fund a rebellion that eventually leads to the demise of the British Empire, he's back there in the 20s, like after the Civil War. Dev sends him over to raise and rally support for the emerging Fianna Fáil party with funds and stuff. And now he's there as president of the Republic.
And, like, and in his age, because just a few months before the end of his term in office, this is March 1959, and he's out of there, out of the IRS in June, and he was desperately trying for several years to get this big trip to the States and the first ever one by an Irish president. He got on famously with Eisenhower, and there's shots of him allegedly flirting, kissing the hand of Mamie Eisenhower in the White House, and hit it off so well with Ike, as he was known, that Eisenhower, the president, cancelled apparently all of his engagements for the next 2 days. And they went on the Raz around Washington, D.C. to all of the Patrick's Day parties.
It's great, isn't it? I know,
You've been there. You've covered some of these St. Patrick's Day events in the White House. What is it like?
Yes, I mean, I've been fortunate enough as a journalist to actually cover, I think I've been in the Oval Office 6 times and never managed to rob an ashtray once, which much to my disgust. And, you know, I have seen close hand that what Sean T started back then really has endured. And it is a huge day out for the Irish. They have access... Irish government has access to the American administration that is the envy of many countries. And because it's not just the Shamrock thing, it's they have a bilateral meeting in the Oval Office and then they go up to Capitol Hill. And particularly in recent fraught times, it's a very, very rare occasion where the Republicans and the Democrats sit and break bread together instead of actually just throwing it at each other. So there's a huge amount of soft power in that. And of course, that is very much part of the soft power of the presidency, just doing that, shaking hands, having the drinks.
But on the parties floor, just to sort of bring it another side of that, with opening the auras to people, he and Phyllis were very instrumental in healing the divide that was caused by the Civil War, because the Ryan family themselves, like, they had split on the issue of the treaty, had been on opposing sides. Family was destroyed. And there's amazing photographs, certainly with Phyllis, that they would invite both Cumannamon and the old IRA, so former, you know, friends who had been enemies, but healing that divide and using the Oars as the place to do it. And there is that amazing photograph. Phyllis is sitting proudly amongst all of our Cumannamon comrades, like girls she would have fought with, she grew up with, who were her enemies, and now they're all together. So you have that other side to it. So he did use his position in so many ways.
That's what we now call the soft power of the president,
yeah,
to pull people together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he lived a good long life. He died in November 1966, aged 85.
Which is a good age now, in fairness. And it is interesting. I mean, he did die 50 years after the Rising. And, you know, he survived the Rising, and there's something kind of poignant.
He lived half a century.
Yeah, yeah. And a lively half century at that.
So whatever about the crack in the Oars?
Yeah, no, don't use those two eggs together. We should have called it that.
The crack in
the Oars. Why didn't you think of that?
And so we were laughing. So whatever about the crack in the Oval Office, there was quite a bit of fun in the Oars as well, wasn't there, during O'Kelly's time?
Well, there certainly was. I mean, he was... First, he was sort of well-liked by the public, who took sort of did knock a bit of crack out of to use that word again, about, you know, the fact that he was a short fella. And he was always photographed with his statuesque wife and also beside the Longfellow an awful lot. But he might have been short, but my God, he had a hollow leg. Like, that man liked an old drink, right? And they ended up installing a Guinness tap into the Oars. And apparently one of the reasons, one story goes that the reason they did actually install the tap was because he liked to sneak out of the Oars. He'd call for the car to be brought around the front of the Oars, and then he'd nip out the back, leg it across the lawn into the pub which abuts Phoenix Park, the hole in the wall. And they couldn't have him roaming around picking up God knows who to bring back to the gaff. So they installed a tap, and there are people who say that they were in there and they drank the Guinness and so on.
One of them is a former colleague of mine, Tom McCochrane, who was a correspondent in the newsroom in RTE, and he was talking about O'Kelly's fondness for the drop as well. And he told the story of a press conference that he was at, which was called by the then president in the Oars. He said it was well known that he was fond of a drop of whiskey, something his wife, Phyllis, was very much disapproving of. And De Valera is reported to have been worried about O'Kelly's drinking as well. Tom says, to our surprise, the first thing Sean T did when we came up for the press conference was ask us to help him to move a large table over against the door. Then he was sure he wouldn't be disturbed by Phyllis, and he took out a bottle of whiskey.
Goes to show who really, really did rule the roost in the Oars. My God.
I'd say, you know, there were a lot of parties as well. So there's a great photograph of the time that Walt Disney visited, along with Sean Connery, Janet Munro and other cast members from Darby O'Gill and The Little People, which was filmed in Dublin.
Appropriate.
June 1959. But someone suggested if they were casting, they could just pop up to Phoenix
Maybe
Park.
That's where Liz was trying to think where she saw him the film early on. Maybe he snuck in the back for a quick shot, you know.
Oh, kind of Jesus.
Senses of the word, yeah. The crack in the Oars, yeah. Where the light, that's how the light gets in, yeah.
Next time, Dev dressed as a woman. Because that's how he did it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they got him a fur coat. And in fact, the key had been smuggled in a birthday cake.
I stop. You're serious.
You've been listening to Think You Know the Presidents, a Today FM production.
Presented by Lise Hand and Flora McCarthy. Researched by Lise Hand, Flora McCarthy and Siobhan Maguire. Recorded by Siobhan Walsh. Sound design by Neil Kavanagh. And produced by Siobhan Maguire.
Archive clips from British Pathé and President.ie.
A big thanks to the Last Word team and the wider Today FM team.
This is a Last Word podcast brought to you by Today FM. You can follow us on Go Loud, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this, please like and leave a review.